Good morning. Welcome to the Saban Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. I'm delighted to have you all here back with us again. As I think every one of you is well aware, one of the things that we have been striving to do here at Brookings ever since 9/11, obviously before that as well, but particularly since 9/11, is to help bridge the gap between the Arab and Muslim world and the United States of America. As many of you experienced, as many people in the country experienced on that awful morning in September 9 years ago, there was a sudden sense that we did not understand here in the United States what was going on in that part of the world, and that we suddenly had an urgent need to understand it much better than we did and than we ever had before. One of the most critical things that we have been doing since that time is trying to help the United States of America to grasp better what it is that is going over there. What are the undercurrents? What are the dynamics? What moves their governments? What moves their industries? And what moves their people? One of the most useful and important things that I think that we have done during this entire period of time is through the good offices of our senior fellow here, Shibli Telhami, on a regular basis, as an annual event, take the pulse of that part of the world and help the United States to get a better sense of what is going on over there and what it is that people want, what it is that they are concerned about, what issues that they're focused on, and what issues that they aren't focused on. As I think it's crystal clear, and as I say again, as we learned on that awful morning, understanding what's going on there has become something of more than mere curiosity to the United States of America. It has become an absolutely critical issue of our national security. And so it is with great pleasure that I invite you and welcome you here to Brookings for our great annual event in which Shibli presents the latest findings of his polling and helps us to grasp where the Arab world is going, where the Muslim world is, what they're thinking about, what their concerns are, and hopes that doing so will help us to better understand what it is that they seek and how our societies can work better over the course of the next year and hopefully for years to come. I think for those in this room, Shibli Telhami is well known to all of you. And I'm only going to give a thumbnail sketch of his background because Shibli is one of these figures who is so well accomplished that I would take up the entirety of his presentation if I tried to really do justice to everything that he has done in the course of his life. Shibli, of course, is the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland, College Park. But as I also just mentioned, we are deeply proud to have him as a non-resident senior fellow at the Saban Center at Brookings. He has previously taught in a variety of academic institutions around the country, Cornell, Ohio State, USC, Princeton, Columbia, Swarthmore, Berkeley, places in between. He is the author of a number of highly regarded books, including most recently his book, The Stakes, America and the Middle East, which was selected by Foreign Affairs as one of the top five books in the Middle East in 2003. He is a member of a variety of professional groups, and I think he is well known to all of you as being one of the most thoughtful and insightful scholars of the Middle East and of the American relationship to the Middle East. Without any further ado, Shibli Telhami.
Thanks so much again for this generous introduction. Good morning. It's really a pleasure to do this and a very important time to review where the Arab public is. Before I start, I just want to thank the Carnegie Corporation of New York for its support, certainly the University of Maryland, my home, for supporting this project, and also my colleague Steve Cull and my assistant Mike Lipson, who have helped give me some good ideas in presenting the data. Let me put this in a little bit of perspective so we understand what is, why this project. As Ken had remarked, certainly after 9/11 there was a lot of interest in it, but really the project dates before 9/11. The notion behind this project was not only to look at, so what do Arabs think? That was not really what the driving force. I mean, we identified in the mid-1990s that there were some very important changes that were taking place in the region, certainly after the end of the Cold War, the first Iraq War, but also because of the media revolution that was having a bearing not only on how people think, but also their notions of identity, how they, you know, how they identify themselves, how given that they have competing collective identities to choose from. And so I set out to study this through a project where I thought I would review what people actually watch on television or what other media they go to on a regular basis, trace that over a period of a decade to see the change from year to year, and correlate that not only with their opinions on major issues, regional issues, international issues, the U.S., social issues, but also on identity, how they define themselves. Is that evolving? Is the transnational media having an impact on the way they define themselves? Is the relationship between the way they define themselves and their political views? So the project is underway. This is actually the ninth year of the project. We have one more to go before it's completed, and then we'll do a lot of analysis. Much of the data that I will be showing here today is important, but it certainly is not all of what we ask. There are a lot of technical things that we try to get at, especially on the media, that will be important for more of a statistical analysis than for the findings of today. But obviously, at any given year, it's very important to know what people are thinking and why, what explains the thinking, how the thinking is evolving. In general, we have done the poll in the same six countries every year: Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Morocco, Jordan, Lebanon, and the United Arab Emirates. We have roughly a sample of 4,000 every year, and they're national representative, they're city-centric, and we therefore study the way it's evolving from year to year. And today, when I'm showing you the data from 2010, I'm going to compare it particularly with the past 2 years, the last year of the Bush administration, the first year of the Obama administration, and now 2010. The last poll, this poll, by the way, was conducted, that's very, very recent. In fact, we had to scramble to get this data out this early because the last day of polling on the ground was July 20th, so just a couple weeks ago. And the last one that I had done in the same six countries was April and May of 2009, and I'm going to give you some of the comparisons that we have. Let me start by we might want the lights dimmed, please, so we can focus more on the data than on me, because that if we could have the lights dimmed for the big screen, that would be great. I just want to give you just a little bit more about the sample size. By the way, overall, the margin of error is about plus or minus 1.6%, but in each country, they vary depending on the sample size. And you can see in Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Morocco, we have larger samples than UAE, Lebanon, and Jordan. We have smaller samples. Let me start with the attitudes toward the United States. What they are in 2010, and how they differ from 2009 and 2008. Recall, this is only Arab world. This is not Muslim countries broadly. I mean, you know, clearly Arab public opinion is differentiated, and you will see that on some issues it really matter whether you're pulling Arabs or you're pulling Indonesians or you're pulling Pakistanis. So we have to keep that in mind. This is an Arab world public opinion poll. It is not Muslim countries' public opinion poll. On attitudes toward the U.S., I think you will find really the first four slides that dramatically tell the story. I don't need to go further, but let me start with the first one. Actually, for whatever reason, this slide, here it is. How would you describe your views of President Barack Obama of the United States? Now look at 2009 and look at 2010. In 2010, we had only 20% who were at least somewhat positive in their view of President Obama. In 2009, 45% were at least somewhat positive. More importantly, look at the negative. In 2009, the only 23% who had at least a somewhat negative view of the president. In 2010, that percentage is 62%, a dramatic change. Now, I'm going to come back to that in a minute, but I want, you know, correlated with that is a view that we measured last year, which was, how would you describe your attitudes toward the Obama administration policy in the Middle East? Are you more hopeful? Are you more discouraged? And what we saw was really stunning, actually, in 2009, especially given what we had studied over the previous 8 years, with people totally pessimistic. We found in 2009, a few months into the Obama administration, 51% of the public saying they're at least somewhat hopeful. That was a surprise to me, even given what I study on a regular basis and see. This year, you can see in 2010, only 16% are somewhat hopeful. 63% are discouraged, at least somewhat discouraged. And let me give you one more. One question we ask is, when you look back at the past year of the Obama administration, which one of the following policies are you most disappointed with? Israel-Palestine, Iraq, attitudes toward Islam, Afghanistan, human rights, spreading democracy, economic assistance. And they're not necessarily put in that order, by the way. We scramble them. So, look at the results. 61% say Israel-Palestine is the issue they're most disappointed with. 27% say Iraq, and the other issues hardly get anything. And I want to just make really two points about this. The first point is the Israel-Palestine. There is no question in my mind that the bulk of the shift in attitudes toward the Obama administration in the Arab world, I don't want to say in Muslim countries, again, remember, I say just in the Arab world, is due to disappointment on this central issue to them. This is the prism through which Arabs view the U.S., and I think that remains to be the case, and it's graphic when you look at the data right now. But it is worth making two points, one about Iraq and one about Afghanistan. You can see that the second most important issue with which they're disappointed is Iraq. And that's a bit puzzling in some ways because actually Arabs liked Obama early on in part because they saw him as having been against the war from the beginning and then said he wants to pull out American forces. And he is, in fact, moving ahead in a difficult environment to fulfill his pledge to withdraw American forces from Iraq. And I think he gets credit for that. This number may have been larger. So why is he getting some disappointment? I think what happened, it's really the outcome of the Iraq elections. There is the instability that has been generated in Iraq. Obviously, the U.S. gets blame for the absence of government in Iraq and the frustration of the public when they see the candidate who won the most seat has not been able to put together the government in Iraq, and he's the one who's supported by the bulk of the Sunni Arab population in Iraq. And so I think that's really the reason with the frustrations there. But note that only 4% say Afghanistan. And this is very, very important because I think that we don't get it sometimes. It's not that people are not following Afghanistan. Afghanistan is actually on Arab news. And if you go on any one of the satellites, the stories from Afghanistan are there. I spent an hour just 2 days ago on Al Jazeera Arabic doing nothing but the WikiLeaks story on the Afghan war. Now, they had a full hour on it. So they get a lot of coverage of that issue. And it's not that Arabs don't care. They do and they follow. But it's not the prism through which they evaluate American foreign policy. It's not the central issue to them, and it's not the prism through which they evaluate American foreign policy. For one thing, they're not really sort of a little confused about, you know, what they want to see in Afghanistan. They're certainly not fond of the Taliban. The Taliban had diplomatic relations only with two countries in the Arab world when they were in power. They're uncertain. And so most of the anger about Afghanistan, when it's there, it's kind of dumping on the U.S. because they're angry with it for other reasons. It's not the source of their opinion toward the U.S. It's just a complicating factor that adds fuel to the fire that's already there. So Afghanistan is not a central issue in the Arab evaluation of American, the Arab public evaluation of American foreign policy, and that's clear. What about, are there issues over which Arabs are pleased when it comes to the Obama administration policy in the Arab world? Well, you can see here in the results, the top issue, 20% say that changed attitudes toward Islam. They noted that. I think it was clear that that was a positive, and that gets the largest number of answers, and then followed by economic assistance, 13%, and human rights as 8%. So those are ones that they're pleased with, but obviously not in the same, sort of lopsided numbers that we saw in the ones that they're displeased with. Before I go further, I'm going to go through, other aspects of attitudes toward the U.S. I want to just do a little bit of reflection on how our press misinterpreted Arab attitudes toward President Obama back in 2008 and 2009. There was a sense that I think in some ways the original data, even the data I just showed, may have given the impression when you say 51% are hopeful about American foreign policy, 45% are somewhat positive about Obama in 2009, a few months after he came to office. There was this, I think, myth that came out in the U.S. that Arabs are in love with Obama because of who he is, because they see him for who he is. And that was never the case. There was no evidence at all that Arabs evaluate him because of who he is. There was no evidence that they were ever in love with him. The reason why it was noticeable that there were positive views of him was that in contrast, in the previous several years, when we asked whom among world leaders do you dislike most in the world, an open question, the President of the United States, George W. Bush, was by far selected as the most disliked leader in the world by a majority of the public. So in contrast, Obama looked good. And when you look at actually the attitudes, even in 2009, if you look at that 45% who said they were somewhat positive, the overwhelming majority of that 45% was somewhat positive. Those who were very positive were only roughly around 10% or so. So there was not an embrace of him. In fact, in the question that I will repeat later today about whom among world leaders do they admire most in an open question, President Barack Obama did not show up in 2009, and he does not show up in 2010 as a major most admired leader. So it's not that they were lukewarm to him, and it was always over issues from the beginning. It wasn't about having anything to do with the Islamic roots or third world roots. That is always a rationalization when you start liking someone. And when you start disliking them, you start a different narrative about them. I'll give you an example. In February, I was on a popular Egyptian television show. And to my surprise, one of the first questions that I was asked was an article in an Egyptian newspaper that was translated from an American newspaper about the president's private spiritual life, talking about how he sees the minister and how he's got some faith. And like most presidents do, actually, when they become presidents, to highlight that particular issue. Well, I found that this kind of question was leading to maybe the president, like George W. Bush, is a secret evangelical, perhaps. Didn't quite put it that way, but I saw that leading in that direction. And the reason for it, of course, is the opposite of what we think. This is not the cause of their thinking. When they start worrying about someone, they start coming up with a different narrative about their background. From the beginning in 2008, when I did polling during our campaign, when there were only three candidates, candidate Obama, candidate Hillary Clinton, and candidate John McCain, I asked them who of the three would be better for the Middle East. And McCain didn't get many. He was getting a lot of bad press about his, Islamo-fascism, so he got something like 3%. But Hillary Clinton got 13%. President Obama got only 18%, just a little ahead. The vast majority, or the plurality of the public, said it wouldn't matter who would become president of the United States. So there was not an embrace of him. It was really about, they started liking him because what he said early on. They were prepared to listen to him. It was his positions on issues. It's what he said, clearly reinforced by his speech in Cairo. They were responding to his policies. And his early popularities had as much to do with his opposition to the Iraq war and different tone in the Muslim world than anything else, not with his background. I think we have to keep that in mind. So now there's a shift because they're evaluating him based on his policies. Now, how does that impact? Let me just go through here the ones that I've already gone through. How does that impact views toward the U.S. in general? Now, this is a question about attitudes toward the U.S. that we've asked every single year from the beginning. So we really have a pretty good trend. And as you can imagine, it's been highly unfavorable, certainly since 9/11, and particularly since the 2003 Iraq War. So this year, you look at 2010 and 2009, it's not a dramatic change. There is certainly of the people who have very unfavorable views, it's pretty much identical, 2010 to 2009. And both year, 2010, 2009, are still better than the last year of the Bush administration, where there was 64% who were very, who had very unfavorable views. A slight increase in the number of people from 2009 to 2010 who had a somewhat unfavorable view. And in some ways, they kind of separate the two, their attitudes toward the administration from attitude toward the U.S. You'll see that in some other questions as well. What two steps by the United States would improve your views of the United States most? Israel-Palestine peace agreement, withdrawal from Iraq, stopping aid to Israel, withdrawal from Arabian Peninsula, pushing more to spread democracy, more economic aid to the region, stopping aid to the Arab governments. And by the way, not always in that order. Again, remember, these are in part due to the results. So when you look at the results, recall they're not going to add up to 100% because we're asking them to identify two issues, so not to force them just to choose one. But you could see the Arab-Israeli issue has increased somewhat since 2009, from 41% to 54%. The Iraq issue diminished a little bit, but still, Arab, Israeli, and Iraq are the top two, stopping aid to Israel, which you can consider as part of the Arab-Israeli issue, although more punitive, is up there, and also withdrawal from the Arabian Peninsula, meaning beyond Iraq, another large number. So in essence, this really tells you the story, because if you look at those four top choices, the two issues for Arabs are Palestine, Israel, and the presence of American forces in the Gulf. Those are the two issues for Arabs. The other issues matter, but they don't matter in anywhere near the same level. And that's very clear, from this graph. And that's been, by the way, the case. I mean, you could see they varied a little bit, 2008, 2009, 2010, a little bit of variation, but there's no question the clustering is right there on those four issues. Which two of the following factors do you believe are most important in driving American policy in the Middle East? This is a question that we started asking from before the Iraq War to see why they think America does what it does in the Middle East. And you can see here, basically, the top two answers are protecting Israel and controlling oil, and then weakening the Muslim world and preventing preserving regional and global dominance. The weakening of the Muslim world went down a little bit, but you know, still, when you take the margin of error into account, it's not a significant change from year to year. They remain roughly the same clusters. Which of the following is closer to your views in describing U.S. President Barack Obama? Now, what I tried to do here is to try to refine to see whether, in fact, they had a personal favorable view of him, separate from his view as president, to try to separate their assessment of him as president a little bit and see if they have a personal view of him. So I gave them choices. I have an unfavorable view of him, and I'm pessimistic about his foreign policy. I have a favorable personal view of him, but I don't think the American political system will allow him to have a successful foreign policy, and I have a favorable personal view of him, and I'm hopeful about his foreign policy, those three. And those are the kind of things I hear when I talk to people and I put them out there. And a majority has an unfavorable personal view of him right now. And 38% have a favorable personal view, but don't think the American system would allow him to be successful in foreign policy. And 5% are optimistic about him. I asked for the first time a question about their attitudes toward the American people. And it's very hard, by the way, for us to compare that. We anecdotally, we know that our public opinion, you know, 15 years ago used to say, I like the American people, but I don't like the American government. And that's not just the Arabs, by the way, much of the world. I mean, you go to Latin America, you might hear the same kind of thing, and you can hear that it was a typical kind of thing. And I didn't actually ask questions related to that before, but we do know that based on anecdotal evidence that the gap has narrowed, that people, particularly after the second election of President Bush, when he was reelected, the reelection of President Bush, that people have started blurring the difference between the American people and American foreign policy. And I wanted to test that this time to see whether, in fact, that's the case. So I asked a question about attitudes toward the American people. And you could see that more or less, while it's not as bad as on American foreign policy in general, still a majority has a somewhat at least unfavorable view of the U.S., and a quarter has a somewhat favorable view of the American public. By the way, on some of the slides you see under 36 and over 36 to give you a flavor, because it turns out, interestingly enough, that age is not much of a factor in all of this. We've done that, and gender for that matter. Surprisingly, opinions are pretty robust across age and gender, except on some questions, particularly the use of the internet, which we will look at, where obviously the younger you are, the more likely you are to use the internet. But in general, we don't have huge differences across age. Let me move to the Arab-Israeli issue. Describe your attitude toward Israel's power. This question we started asking after the 2006 war with Hezbollah, Israel's war with Hezbollah, because what we wanted to see is whether, in fact, this idea of deterrence was being internalized by the public, whether or not they think Israel is powerful a week after military attacks. And we started documenting it. The first option is Israel is very powerful and is likely to use its power to consolidate its position. The second is it has its strengths and weaknesses. And the third is Israel is weaker than it looks. And we've measured that beginning with 2006. You can see that actually, even dating back to 2006, those who say that Israel is very powerful and likely to consolidate its position are really a small minority. But they are divided between being kind of, we can call it realism, Israel has its strengths and weaknesses, and those who think that Israel is weaker than it looks. There is a change from 2008 to 2010, 2009, 2010 on the it's weaker than it looks. If you look at it, if you division by age, a little bit of a difference, but not a huge difference. Which of the following statements is closer to your views? I'm prepared for peace with Israel based on the 67 borders and think that Arab governments should do more to make that happen. I'm prepared for peace with Israel based on the 67 borders, but don't think the Israelis will ever accept it. And even if Israel returns all of the 67 territories, Arabs should continue to fight. And this is really a test, not so much of the terms of an agreement. It's a test of whether, in principle, people are kind of open to an agreement or not. That's really the test. And so you could see, here's the fascinating story, how robust the results have been, even in this environment of increasing pessimism. In fact, if anything, the number of people who are in principle opposed to an agreement is at the lowest point we've ever measured it. Only 12% who say, even if Israel returns all the territories, we should continue to fight. That's only 12%. And it dropped. It was 25% last year. You have 86% say, in principle, they're prepared for a two-state solution. But you also notice the dramatic change in the second category. And that is where they say Israel will never accept this. So 56, a majority, say, yeah, I'm prepared to accept it, but Israel will never accept it. So in essence, that is something that you see. By the way, it's the mirror image of what you see in Israel, where you have polls show that majorities in principle, although, again, we don't know the terms, in principle support of a two-state solution, but they don't think the other side will ever accept it. And so you have that mirror image kind of thing that we see. I'm just go through here. What do you believe motivates Israeli policies in the region and American support for these policies? Now, this is a question that we started asking a few years ago because what theories do people have about American foreign policy? The first one, I call it the Israel lobby thesis. The second one, I call it the American imperialism thesis. And the third one is the common interest thesis. Because, you know, there are basically in the debate in the Arab world, there is a, the Israel lobby argument that Israel lobby drives American foreign policy in the Middle East. But there's also a lot talked about the Chomsky type argument that, in essence, Israel is an instrument of American imperialism. And the U.S. is using Israel to bolster its expansionism. And it has some adherence. It's had some adherence in the Arab world. And the third is essentially that they're common interests of Israel and the United States. That's really what explains American foreign policy. 47% this year believe, in essence, you know, what one might call the Israel lobby argument. 20% accept what I call the imperialism argument, and 33% think it's overlapping interests. I think what's interesting, particularly in comparison to 2008, is the common interest argument has declined. Maybe that's kind of part of maybe the tension to Israel and the U.S. is beginning to show a little bit over the year, that you had 41%. The biggest argument was in 2008 was that they have overlapping interests. And the lobby argument and the American imperialism argument were roughly equal. And this year, nearly half by the lobby argument. So that has clearly taken more hold in the discourse than before. What do you believe is the likely outcome of the prospects if a two-state solution in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict collapse? And realism. Remarkable realism. 57%, roughly, you know, the same, not much change from 2006 and 2009, 2008, state of intense conflict. roughly 30% say status quo will continue. And look, the one-state solution, only about 10% believe that would happen if the two-state solution does not take place. And only 2% believe the Palestinians would eventually give up. So it's a degree of realism that is coupled with a pessimism to give a fascinating outcome, and you'll see that in a minute, sort of what the net result of that is. Which of the following statements is closest to your view about the prospects of lasting peace between Israel and the Palestinians? I don't think it'll ever happen. It's inevitable, but it'll take more time. It will happen in the next 5 years. And again, very stable results for at least four don't think it's going to happen ever. You have basically over half believe it'll never happen. And you have 40% who say it'll happen, but not anytime soon. Still an improvement over 2008. In the current, let me just see, there's one other question here. Okay. In the current conflict among Palestinians, with whom do you sympathize most? Fatah, Hamas, both to some extent, or other, none, or none of the above? This is specific to the Palestinian politics. Look at the result. The biggest change is both to some extent categories expanded. People are, I think, a little confused about, you know, what's happening. The support for either side diminished. You know, the support for Fatah went down from 12% to 7%, for Hamas from 22% to 13%. But it's still among those who take sides, you can see that more people actually take Hamas's side than Fatah's side in Arab public opinion. Remember, this does not include the Palestinians. So this is not Palestinian public opinion. This is Arab public opinion in the six countries outside of the area. So it's not identical. As you look at the internal Palestinian political divisions, do you prefer to see a Fatah government, a Hamas government, or a national unity government? Which would you rather see? And we have consistently seen a majority say they want to see a national unity government, but interestingly, that has diminished from last year, and more people say none of the above, basically. But very few people want to see either a Hamas government or a Fatah government. That's very clear. And that's, by the way, why every Arab government tries to look like it's the mediator to try to bring them together, even countries that may not be so excited about having them come together, because it plays well with their public opinion. A solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict that leads to the establishment of a Palestinian state will happen only, A, through serious negotiations, by being imposed by the UN, by being imposed by the United States, through another Arab-Israeli war, and it'll never happen. Now, I'm basically pushing them, even those who will think it'll never happen. Well, if it's going to happen, what is the, you know, how is it going to happen? Is it going to happen through this way or that way? I didn't know what to expect, to be honest with you. And these are the kind of questions. This is the first time I asked this particular question, but remember the context. More than two-thirds, over 80%, are open to the two-state solution. A majority don't think it'll ever happen. They're frustrated and pessimistic. If the two-state solution collapses, they think it'll be violence for years to come. And that's basically the context. And all of that actually ends up generating a surprisingly realistic assessment. Look at the just the red. The other is just division over 36 and under 36. But look at the red line. The plurality, 39%, say it'll happen only through negotiations. Those who think it'll happen through another Arab-Israeli war, 16%. Those who think it'll happen through UN imposition are 18%, and through imposition by the U.S., 13%. They're scattered all over, but it's clear that a plurality still think it's negotiations. It just gives you the dilemma of the public in this environment of all these contradictions that are creating a somewhat realistic assessment. When you look at the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which of the following issues is the most central to you, assuming that they may be all important? Now, I'm forcing them to choose here. If you look actually at the first one is establishment of a fully independent Palestinian state. The second is Arab sovereignty over Jerusalem. And the third is the right of refugees to return to their homes. Unquestionably, these are the biggest issues, you know, the big category. Let's put a Palestinian state together that's viable and independent on the West Bank and Gaza. People who think that Arab sovereignty over East Jerusalem is central and the refugee issue. So I know that you're all important to them. So this is not a choice if the others are not important, but which one do they rank higher is the question. And it is interesting. They vary from country to country, by the way. I'm not putting it here, but we could discuss that later on. But you could see that nearly half say the establishment of an independent Palestinian state. The second category, 31%, say Arab sovereignty over East Jerusalem. And the refugee issue gets about 21%. Not much variation across age. And there is country-by-country differentiation. You can see that countries that like Jordan, which has a high refugee population, they rank the refugee issue higher, 39%. Lebanon, the same. They rank the refugee issues 34%, a little bit higher. So there is some variation. The Islamic issue, the East Jerusalem issue, is particularly important in Morocco, and you'll see how that works out in their identity as well. In your opinion, what has been the most important consequence of the Israeli attack on the Gaza flotilla? As you know, this took place after the Gaza flotilla, so I asked a quick question about sort of in their mind, what sort of outcome that attack generated. Here are the answers. 30% say the tension in Turkish-Israeli relations. 24% say the international unanimity in condemning Israel. 24% say that it focused attention on the Gaza blockade. But only 7% believe it brought the Israeli-Palestinian conflict closer to a resolution. So they think it had impact strategically and maybe in humanitarian ways, but they don't think in the end it has much of an impact on the resolution of the Arab-Israeli conflict. This is a kind of a popularity contest in the Arab world of Palestinian leaders. You can see there's really not much, they're kind of roughly the same. They go Khalid Mash'al of Hamas and Mahmoud Abbas are, roughly the same. Marwan Barghouti, Ismail Haniyeh, Saeb Erekat, but they're divided between Hamas people and Fatah people. I don't think the public has a, they see them on the news. I don't think they have a particular sense. And I think one of the things that's very interesting that to think about in terms of Arab public opinion, while the Arabs in general look at the world through the prism of Palestine, they're confused about who is the one who's speaking for the Palestinians. And this kind of shows the confusion. And so they can't figure out what's good and what's not good. They're hearing a story from Hamas. They're hearing a story from Fatah. They're hearing divisions even within each camp. They're hearing different Arab states speaking for them. So there's a little bit of confusion as to where they go for references. I'm going to skip. I just want to tell you something about this category of empathy. For the first time, we started studying the extent to which people are capable of empathizing with each other in the middle of conflict. I'm doing that. I'm going to follow up with this. I'm doing another poll in the next month in Israel itself, but among Arab citizens and Jewish citizens on the question of empathy, because I think we expect some different results, but the numbers will be different. But what I hypothesized was that usually when empathy is a threat to your notion of identity, you're not capable of doing it in the middle of a conflict. And that's why I think people misunderstand this issue of incitement that we talk about and its role on each side. And the initial results of this poll, which is I do for the first time, indicate that. If you look, for example, at, say, when you watch a movie or program about the Jewish Holocaust, which of the following is closest to your feeling? I have mixed feelings. I empathize with Jews who suffered under the Nazis. I resent it, as I feel it brings sympathy toward Israel and Jews at the expense of the Palestinians and the Arabs. And remember, you're fighting for global sympathy. And so it's instrumental, 59-29. We haven't done the study among Israelis yet, but I could tell you that if you look at the press, what people call incitement, let's say when there is an Arab TV show showing bloody civilian casualties on the Arab side, people criticize that as inciting the public rather than trying to learn from it that maybe there's something here to human that you should react to. It works both ways. We're going to study it a little bit more, but that's what we see already happening here. And we see that even more clearly on when they see Israeli casualties, civilian casualties, and Palestinian civilian casualties. And here we say when you see Palestinian casualties with Israel, which two of the following best describe your feelings? 59% feel empathy for the Palestinians, 47% feel need for revenge. Basically, it's a instinctive, and it's quite the opposite of what they feel when they see Israeli civilian casualties. 59% feel a need for revenge, 35% feel anger with Israeli leaders, 75% feel Israelis brought it upon themselves. So it's you have this kind of sentiment that we have to understand in conflict. It's very tough to empathize. Expect to find something parallel on the Israeli side. The numbers may differ depending on proximity. Very quickly, I want to go through attitudes toward Iran. Do you believe that Iran is merely conducting research for peaceful purposes or trying to develop nuclear weapons? Straightforward question. You can see here that the last 2 years are roughly identical, but it changed from 2008. More people now believe that Iran is actually trying to acquire nuclear weapons. 57% believe that Iran is trying to acquire nuclear weapons. But look at the reaction. Do you believe that Iran is, there is international pressure on Iran to curtail its nuclear program. What is your opinion? Iran has the right to its nuclear program, or Iran should be pressured to stop its nuclear program? And look at the outcome. 77% say Iran has the right to its nuclear program. It changed from only 53% in 2009. In 2008, it was actually high, 267. Only 20% say Iran should be pressured. Not much change along age. I broke that down based on people who think Iran is actually trying to acquire nuclear weapons and people who think Iran is doing it for peaceful purposes. You could see the right is Iran seeks nuclear weapons. When you divide it, you get more people among those who think Iran is only doing a peaceful program. 92% say it shouldn't be pressured. But even among those who think that Iran is actually trying to develop nuclear weapons, 70% think Iran shouldn't be pressured. It varies from country to country, as you might imagine. Egypt and Morocco, by far, Iran has the right to its nuclear weapons. Interestingly, Saudi Arabia is divided. And the UAE, not surprisingly, is a country where you have the greatest opposition. If Iran acquires nuclear weapons, which of the following is the likely outcome for the Middle East region? More positive, would not matter, or more negative? A question we asked in the past. And look at this. In 2009, 29% said it would be more positive. In 2010, 57% say it would be more positive. It's a dramatic shift from 2009. And let me postulate the following. This is highly correlated to how they feel about the United States of America and hopefulness of American foreign policy. This doesn't mean they like Iran. If I were to evaluate Iran Arabs have mixed feelings about Iran, and some actually don't like Iran at all. So this is about whether they see Iran as the biggest threat. And so it's mostly a reaction. It's mostly a venting. It's an anger. It's an expression of anger and pessimism about the effectiveness of American foreign policy, and they see Iran in that perspective. And that's why I think in 2009, when you saw hopefulness about American foreign policy had a decline, now that you see a little more pessimism, you have an increase. So it's very much a function, in my opinion, of that judgment. It's not separate. It's not an evaluation of Iran in and of itself. It is Iran in the context of their worldview, the prospect of Arab-Israeli issue, and their attitudes toward the United States of America. This is just through the same division. I want to just very quickly, I want to come back to questions and answers, so I want to go through rapidly with just two quick results pertaining to worldviews. We ask questions typically about who they like to see as the, if in a world where there's only one superpower, who they would like to see as that sole superpower. This is not an open question. I give them seven choices, and I've been giving them the same seven choices. And I selected them with, for a variety of reasons when I started it. I only included one Muslim country because it was the only nuclear power, and just to use that because people were talking about Islam as a factor in the way they see the world. And I just have to tell you, every single year France has been on the top, and it still is, in fact, in a big way right now. China has increased over time. And the U.S. has been roughly around the same 7-8%, not very high on that picture. The same thing when you ask if you have to live in one of the same those seven countries, where would you live? You have 51% say France, 70% say Germany. It's very fascinating about France, given you know what else happened there. U.S. only 7%. And China has become, you know, viable as a place to live remarkably over the past few years. Not Russia, not Pakistan, but China has become viable. When you ask them, where would they study, or family member, if they had to send a family member to study, where would they study? That's a little different. The U.S. is still up there. That's an area where they still see the U.S. as leading, 20%, you know, roughly the same as Germany and Britain. France is still number one, but China, Russia, and Pakistan are not in the picture. But the U.S. is still a central player in that game. Name the two countries that pose the biggest threat to you personally and consistent every year from the beginning. 88% name Israel. 77% name the U.S., 10% name Iran. Now, Algeria, all of that is Morocco. All of it is Morocco, the 10% that you see there, because we weight this definition. Algeria does not come up. All of it is in Morocco. I mean, you have to keep that in mind because these are weighted averages. So from country to country, they vary. But across all countries, including the Gulf countries, the trends work out the same, meaning that the two top threats are seen to be Israel and the U.S. Which two countries, Arab and non-Arab, outside your own, are playing the most constructive role in the interest of the Middle East region? And France, number one again, but Turkey now is number two. And that, again, is an outcome of the flotilla incident, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and then you go down the road, and it varies from country to country what they think. Name two countries where you think there's most freedom and democracy for their people. Again, we've had, you know, the primarily Western countries. This is an open question. They can name any country they want. They go France, the United States is still seen as a place where there's freedom. Germany, Canada, Japan, Switzerland. Sweden, Italy, but notice it's not really Arab countries. And they can name countries, any two countries in the world. This is an annual, again, open question I ask every year. Which world leader outside your own do you admire most? I don't give them names. These are the names that were mentioned. This is an open question. They can name anyone they want. I have to tell you, this is not a popularity context. The aim of this question from the beginning, as I designed it, was not to know who's popular, but to know what is driving their thinking. You know, what is the implicit thing that makes them go to this person or that person? What are the issues? What prism are they looking through when they're making these answers? And that's really where the insight comes, not so much, oh, you know, Chavez is popular or Erdogan is popular. I mean, that's a sideshow. But as it turns out, in 2010, not surprisingly, the prime minister of Turkey rises to number one after the Gaza events. He only had 4% in 2009, dramatic. Chavez had a lot of support in 2004, all of which was because of the Gaza war, all of which was because he severed relations with Israel, took a high profile. They don't know who he is, but they're rewarding him for that. Nasrallah has dipped from his high of 27 in 2008 since the war. But then, you know, it's scattered all over the place. I'm going to just say one more thing about identity, and I'm going to end up with a note about the media. You know, it's interesting. One of the things that I'm very interested in studying is whether there's a shift in the way people define themselves. It's always in flux. People are at the same time Arab, Muslim, Jordanian, Egyptian. You know, you can't take any of that away from them. There are periods in history where they put a lot of weight on one over the others, like during 1950s pan-Arabism, let's say. And now it's been interesting over the past decade, this identity has been in flux, and from year to year there's a variation, particularly in particular countries. But the trend, you know, is very interesting in 2009 because you could see that Muslim identity is highest. 39% say it's number one. 31% identify with the country, and 23% identify themselves most as Arabs. And when you ask, interestingly, when you go to a combination, when you combine both identities, first and second, because I asked them, which is your first most important identity, which is your second most important identity, and I combine first choice and second choice to see, you know, what it looks like, you can check and see in 2010 that actually state identity is the weakest. Islamic identity is number one, and Arab identity is number two when you combine the two. Regardless, even when you look at state identity of people getting one-third, two-thirds of the public is making an identification with transnational movements. Transnational, whether it's Islam or Arab, and it's very interesting to see that. I'll end with the media because I said, you know, part of it is studying the media, and I just want to review some of the results. One of the things that when we started doing this, there were very few people watching satellite TV. It rapidly grew dramatically. In Morocco, very few people watched Al Jazeera in 2000. Very few people watched Al Jazeera. In 2010, the vast majority of Moroccans say Al Jazeera is their first choice for news. What I tried to do is also document the growth of the Internet. There was practically zero use of the Internet, and now there's substantial use of the Internet, and we're correlating that. The numbers I'm going to give you are not market shares. Keep that in mind. We have data on market share, extensive, actually, for further analysis where we ask people how many times they watch each channel, how many times a day, and so forth. A lot of questions that we're keeping it for statistical analysis. But for my own purpose, I always believe that you need to ask them for analytical reasons to find out whether there's a relationship between what they watch and how they feel, is which one is their first choice and which one is their second choice. Because it's really, that's what matters. You know, where are they getting most of the bulk of their news? That's where the story is. And so the questions that I formulate are really about how they rank them, not about whether they have a market share. And keep that in mind. In 2010, you could see the rapid growth of the use of the internet. 40% now say they use the internet at least several times a week. That's pretty remarkable. And then another 31% several times a month, and only 28% say never. And look at the dip just from 2008, look at the never category, 52% in 2008, 28% now. It's really quite remarkable. It's even better looking, when you look at division of age. You know, the younger people have more use. You could see that in this graph. Under 36, 45% use it several times a week. Now, what about the Arab satellites? In 2009, 2008, Al Jazeera, 55%, 53% said Al Jazeera was their first choice for news. In 2010, 39% said Al Jazeera is their first choice for news. This is in almost entirely a function of a change in Egypt as a first choice, people saying Egyptian TV. Is there many more people saying Egyptian TV? When you take Egypt out, actually the numbers don't change at all. 47% without Egypt was identical almost to the same percentage in 2008 for the combined five countries without Egypt. In Egypt, there are a couple of things that happened. One of them that in 2009, there was a particularly high viewership, an increase in the Al Jazeera viewership in Egypt because of the Gaza War. The Gaza War and how it was covered by Al Jazeera, people were going to Al Jazeera for it, and we see that having declined. If you ask them to identify first and second choice for news combined, then you get a very interesting percentage. You get Al Jazeera by far dominates, in fact, slightly increased since 2008. Egyptian TV is high, but only in Egypt. Remember, I should repeat this. This is a six-country weighted average. By weighted, it means weighted by population. It means when Egypt is included, Egypt accounts for roughly half of the sample. And so high percentages in Egypt are going to be reflected. Egyptian TV is not very much watched outside of Egypt these days. It used to be, but not much anymore. Not for news. For entertainment, yes, but not for news. And so you have this, Al Arabiya has a combined 31%, and NBC has a combined 19%, and that is NBC is very important, by the way, because it shows up as the leader in the entertainment news. Not by a large number, only 12%, but the entertainment numbers, you could see them here, 2010, 12% say NBC is their first choice for entertainment. The entertainment news is very fragmented. People go to various things. But one final point on the media, which is when you look at the, you know, we're focused on the U.S. On the news arena. But when you ask people, when you watch television, how many days per week do you watch American or European movies, shows, or music videos? And you look at the number, and it's quite telling. You know, whether you look at it as divided or over 36, under 36, you have half of the population seeing it daily. And if you talk it 5 to 6 times a week, that's basically almost 2/3 of the population. Seeing American movies and European movies. Several times a week. So the news is not the only story. I'm going to end here, and I welcome your questions. I'll take the questions from the floor, and we could proceed accordingly. Yeah.
Certainly. Thank you again for this. I'm Tom Gettman, former NGO executive. This is especially helpful in our teaching and our advocacy. But what this all begs is, are people on Pennsylvania Avenue standing on tiptoe to have you come and explain this to them like you've explained it to us? Do you have access to draw some conclusions for them?
First of all, could you identify yourself before?
Yes, Tom Gettman, former NGO executive, now a teacher.
Thanks. And I please identify yourself when you speak. Yes, I can't say that I lack an access from the beginning, with even with the Bush administration originally, but certainly with this administration, briefing certainly before the Cairo speech and after. Yes, there is. I don't think that this information is absent. I don't think that's why we're having complications in the pursuit of foreign policy. I think there's plenty of information inside. I think the picture is more complex, but I cannot complain about access. I have plenty of it. George.
George Hishmi. I'm wondering whether the views of you Arab governments reflect the views of the Arab people as a consequence of your results. Thank you.
Whether they respect them, is that what you're saying? Well, it's a very good question. I'm a student of international relations before being a student of the Middle East, and I've always believed, I still do, that governments are first and foremost there to keep themselves in power, all governments, and plus then they do what they have to do, and they have an agenda. They have beliefs. There's some that have even moral agendas, but first and foremost, they're out there to make sure they stay in power, and that goes for every government in the world, including Arab governments. And so when you ask me how they behave, you have to look at how they define their interests. Arab public opinion matters to them increasingly because they cannot ignore it. They can't shape it, for one thing. This is going independently from them. That's been a function of the media and as well as the new internet arena. It's posed a lot of dilemmas for them, and they've had to adjust themselves. On some issues, they differ very markedly from their public opinion. On the attitudes toward Iran, in particular, the views of Arab governments are very different. In terms of the popularity of leaders, I can't tell you that Hassan Nasrallah is popular among Arab governments, except perhaps next door in Syria. So, no, they're not identical. And it's very important to keep that in mind, because on the Iran issue, and I keep saying that when you are an American official, you're dealing with governments, and you hear what governments want to see happen on the Iran issue, and often it varies from country to country. It's not identical. Every country has its own interests, but it's certainly not identical with public opinion. Yeah, Mr. Shinawi.
Mohammed Shinawi, Voice of America. Dr. Tarhami, what do these findings tell U.S. policymakers and public diplomacy planners?
I've served on a commission of public diplomacy, so I think public diplomacy matters. I have even served on something called on the American side as an American representative of a trilateral American-Israeli-Palestinian Committee on Anti-Incitement during the Oslo negotiations. I think that those things matter. But as we have said in all the reports, it's not about public diplomacy. Public diplomacy matters on some things, but the bulk of the attitudes in the region are really about core issues, and those are the core issues that matter and shape. It's not about whether, the Bush administration had an effective public diplomacy with advertising, or we have good speeches with tone that might make people listen for a day, for a week, but then they're going to evaluate you on the core issues. So I think there's no escaping, and the numbers are clear. People are making up their mind when they look at the U.S. and American foreign policy through core issues, mostly the Arab-Israeli issue, also the Iraq issue, the American presence, and then a few others. The others matter. I don't discount them. Sometimes that's all you can work with, but they're not going to shift public opinion for you. Yeah. And then I'll go in the back.
Ulrike Franke from the German Embassy. Could you explain the very positive attitude of Arabs towards France, and also especially the shift that seems to have taken place in the last year from Germany and other European countries towards France?
Well, actually, France, there's a slight increase in the support for France this time, but France has been consistently number one. Even when the issue of the veil in schools was in there, and even when the riots were there for the immigrants, France was number one. Now, why? It's very complicated, because it has in part to do with their view of the U.S. And the core issues of French policy toward the Arab-Israel issue and the Iraq issue. It began in the recent years, really with Jacques Chirac's opposition to the Iraq War. In 2002, 2003, 2004, Jacques Chirac was identified as the single most popular leader in the Arab world in an open question, even as some of these things were happening in France. And it was mostly because he was seen to have stood up to George W. Bush and have seen to have been, you know, favorable on the Palestinian issue. France is seen as, you know, as a European country that you could see when they look at the values and where they want to study, where they think there's democracy. They prefer Western European countries and the U.S. in reality. So they have to, you know, the choice of France for them is, I think, is largely political. It obviously also has to do with the mixed experience of the immigrants from North Africa. We talk about the negative part of it, but the other part of it is, if you go to France, you go to Paris, it's very hard to go to. I can almost get away with my Arabic in Paris. I mean, there's such a big chunk of the population. And so there is a certain identification that comes with that. I don't know what explains the spike over last year. It's hard to know for sure. I haven't looked at it closely enough. I will do so, you know, as I analyze it a little bit more. Yeah.
Thank you, Shibli. I'm Ori Mir with Americans for Peace Now, and I'd like to ask you to take a bird's eye view, if you will, regarding the Arab-Israeli conflict and views on it, both in terms of what it means, what you've shown us means. You use the word realism. Would you use pragmatism? The other way in which I'd like you to take the bird's eye view is to go a little farther back beyond 08 and look at data from previous years as well, if you may.
Okay. You know, I'm going to give you, in a way, my own take on public opinion. I keep referring to my academic background. You know, I'm foremost student of international relations, and I'm sympathetic with political realism up to a point. And so I know what drives behaviors of people, states, political entities, and I also know that public opinion can change. And it's not, when I say public opinion is not the reason generally for having a problem. It is a symptom that tells you what you need to do. So public opinion is not unchangeable. It is changeable. And in fact, I think often political leaders don't understand that. I think decisive leadership in a divided polity can take with it 20% to 25% of the public and shift it their way the minute they make a dramatic decision that propels the public to focus on the issue. I think public opinion can shift. We've seen it shift. You know, look at the attitudes of Israelis and Palestinians after they signed the Oslo agreements, how they shifted dramatically overnight. After Sadat went to Jerusalem, what happened in the psychology. These things happen. But they happen over concrete issues, not over superficial statements. You can win them over by words up to a point, but in the end, you have to deliver something. And so I think when I look at the Arab-Israeli, when I look at Arab attitudes toward the Arab-Israeli issue and Arab attitudes toward the U.S., and by the way, I think Israeli attitude, I'm a student of Israeli attitudes as well. I'm not talking about it here. When you look at that, they're beyond listening to word. They don't believe anymore. I mean, they've exhausted that. You could never formulate another promise that they will trust. There's very little trust. They've gone through it multiple times. They've been let down over and over and over again. And there is no way you're going to sway them dramatically by virtue of a new formulation. But in my judgment, if you look at the numbers, where they are and their realism, if you do have a plan that is roughly along that line, and there's an agreement on it, and it's put to them tomorrow morning, you're going to be shocked to see how many people will jump on it. And I think that's what it tells me. It tells me that, you know, we're beyond the point where you can play around with this, manage it, hope to control it, sway it by tactics and design and language. We're at a point where some concrete decision is going to have to be made. We know that change happens. It is likely to happen. Wars change a lot. Obviously, if you, you know, when we say there's an agreement could shift something, wars could shift something. Those are the sort of things that are likely to create the kind of change, but we're not likely to see it by virtue of saying, well, let's go have a different approach. A different approach is just not going to do it. Yes, in the back.
To me, there seemed, my name is Alicia Bonner with the Institute for the Study of War. The dramatic change in public opinion regarding Iranian nuclear weapons, to what do you attribute that, and what are the implications of that for the region?
There are two things really going on. One of it is very clear. If I ask people, is Iran a threat, I think you're going to get a good number of people who see Iran as a threat, whether they're not just in the UAE or Saudi Arabia, but also, in Egypt and Jordan. So Iran is not – you don't have big fans of Iran. You have some, but not big fans of Iran. But what you do have is the evaluation of Iran through a sense of bigger threats. That's why I asked the question, identify the two biggest threats to you personally. When you have, over 80% of people say Israel and the U.S. is close to that, then the Iran issue becomes marginalized. And so they look at Iran through the prism of the bigger threats to them in the way they evaluate it. So the evaluation isn't really about Iran. It's about how Iran plays. It's a lot of it is the enemy of my enemy. A lot of it is the enemy of my enemy. And in attitudes toward Iran, that's not always the case with all the issues. For example, with Hassan Nasrallah, I think there is an embrace of him by a segment of the Arab public. Even the prime minister of Turkey, it's not just all the enemy of my enemy. It's a little bit of embrace. So it's complicated. But with Iran, I think it's mostly a sense of the enemy of my enemy. And I think the dramatic shift, you can see it, from majority optimism about the Obama administration policy in the Middle East and prepared to therefore push the Iran issue back as maybe an obstacle to the delivery, to no, we can't believe anymore, we're pessimistic, let the extremists do what they have to do. So I see it more along these lines than anything else. Yes.
I'm Bill Coleman. I'm a practicing lawyer in Washington, D.C. At the beginning of your remarks, when you were indicating about whether the Israelis and the Arabs would make a settlement, you gave some figures. But which line were you talking about? You clearly weren't talking about the 1919 line. And you perhaps were talking about the 69 line. But I would say that both of them, one wants more and one wants less. And secondly, the other day I was at dinner up in Vermont, and one lady was from France, one was from Germany, and the other one from Mexico. And I foolishly asked all three of them, what do you think of America? And they also had some very bad feelings towards America. So the idea that when you try to measure how people feel in the Middle East, it's just the fact that I think people all over the world feel that way, perhaps other than the British.
I think you were referring to the 67 border, 48 versus 67. Well, the question that I asked is specific to the 67 border. Would you accept a two-state solution based on the 67 border? So that was very clear. Now, as I said when I put that question up there, that was not an attempt to get at sort of what are they prepared to give or take. It was more about the principle. Are they in principle accepted even if they negotiate it, or are they in principle going to reject it? And so you have clearly a majority in the Arab public that is in principle prepared to accept the two-state solution, and that's really the important finding right there. Yeah.
My name is Connie Zulam. I'm with the American Kurdish Information Network. What do you make of the popularity of the Turkish prime minister among the participants of your poll? Do you think they know he is an oppressor of the Kurds and they still like him, or they're clueless about the Kurdish situation in Turkey?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I don't think the issue when they evaluate leaders, that's what I said when I revealed the data about how they evaluate leaders. They don't make a rational assessment of how is this leader behaving in their own country. Like, do they know anything about what happens in Venezuela by Chavez? Not much. So when they're making the evaluation, it tells me that the evaluation is primarily based on who's being good on the issue that they care most about, and primarily the Israel-Palestine issue, to some extent the Iraq issue, but primarily the Israel-Palestine issue. So there, most of the embrace of him is over the issue of his standing on Gaza and particularly after the Gaza flotilla. But I think even during the Gaza war, after 2008, 2009, we started seeing that in some countries he was gaining. They're not looking at it through the Kurdish issue. That's not the one that comes up at the top. Yeah.
I'm Mohtaber Sherwani with VOA Kurdish Service. Since my question originally was about Iran, it's interesting to me that public opinion does matter, and even world trying to prove that Iran has in every intention to have to acquire nuclear weapons, but the public opinion knows that too. But still, they don't see it as a positive thing for the Middle East region. I was wondering, you said the enemy of my enemy. Can you elaborate on that more? And also, quick question on Iraq and their disappointment is on U.S. policy towards Iraq, although they support the withdrawal from Iraq. What is that their expectation from United States to help Iraqis to have a government or impose a government? How do they want United States have a role?
A good question, and I'm not sure that there is a way to win them, actually. But I would say one thing on the Iraq issue, which is that, by and large, remember that the vast majority of Arab Muslims are Sunni Muslims. And in some ways, they look at Iraq in part through the prism of Sunni Iraqis. And so if you want to know, what kind of outcome would they like to see, you say their prism of evaluation is what they think Iraqi Sunnis want to see. That is really the shortest cut to figuring out where they are and how they would like to see it. And right now, the Iyad Alawi faction is the one that is seen to be there. That's where they're all clustered. But that's the mindset at the public opinion level. Now, the question of Iran is really interesting, because on the one hand, some of it is related to the strategic picture, which is, Arabs and Muslims have to be materially stronger to be able to balance, Israel and the U.S. in an environment where we don't see peace possible. And so they're going to give them a black eye. I would even dare say that some people who want to see war between Israel and Iran, not many in the Arab world, but there are a segment that wants to see it, who primarily want to see it because they say to themselves, we don't like Israel, we don't like Iran, they're two powerful countries, let them hurt each other, in the same way that Israelis looked at the Iraq-Iran war. During the 1980s, it said two countries we don't like and they're weakening each other. So there is that part of it as well. But there is a second assessment, which is that Iran, even a nuclear Iran, is not going to be so mad as to use nuclear weapons. They don't think it's likely to be used. Now, how do we know that? Well, we know that because one of the control, I've been doing a little bit of a control poll, I'm going to repeat it, among Palestinian citizens of Israel. And when you compare their views with Israeli Jewish views, you would find that most of them are not as worried about Iran's nuclear issue. Well, why? I mean, if Iran was going to hit Haifa, Arabs and Jews are going to be destroyed equally. And so, but the bottom line is the vast majority of Israelis are persuaded somehow psychologically that it's going to have horrible ramifications for them. even Palestinian citizens of Israel are not so persuaded that it's going to have horrible consequences for them. So that's why I think opinions of that sort are more a function of identity and threats to identity than they are of an objective analysis of ramifications of the issues themselves. That's why I'm studying it in conjunction, sort of the relations between media, identity, and opinion, which I will be obviously analyzing in the coming weeks. Thank you so much for coming. Really appreciate your patience.